The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
When you say, just before you dive into that, that they couldn't leave, if they had the technology to get here, why?
Because of the cataclysm that had happened with Tiamat.
The cataclysm, so...
The solar upheavals.
So the...
The celestial upheaval.
Okay, so something was keeping them
Was keeping them here. It was so severe, and I'm thinking that there's something that was keeping them here. But I think originally they were just a little bit, they probably wanted to colonize this planet anyway. So I think they had various reasons for staying, not just one, but several. I think one of the things was fear of leaving. They didn't know, for instance, if those pursuers were out there. So they wanted to sort of stick around. Then they wanted to colonize the planet. They realized it was very well rich. And I think that there was a fear of leaving. There's a bunch of components. And one very important, all conclusive reason, but we'll have to come to that in a minute. Where we are in the story now is that
they'd been snubbed.
Yeah, and the wrath, the books describe the incredible wrath of the Atlanteans against the Lemurians. And they respond with what the records clearly describe as a war, an atomic war, a global thermonuclear war.
Whoa. Yeah. So we're talking about the dawn of man, the dawn of what we believe civilization is. And it started with a nuclear war?
We're talking about that, not right away. I mean, the coming of these beings was about 50,000 years ago. The war we're talking about was about 14 to 13,000 years ago. So there had been a lot of time elapsed while the building of Atlantis, the colonization of the planet, the various hybridization programs, many thousands of years have elapsed in this time. But around about 13 to 14,000 years ago, there was this war. All the records are now speaking about it. The fossil record is your best, you know, betrayer of this fact, and those who've done their homework, and there are many of the top scientists of the world have proved this now. This is why this information is finally coming out. They have shown that there was something devastating here. Now, remember the we talked about the deluge? It was originally thought that the evidence that they see in the fossil record from about 13,000 years ago that shows untold extinctions on this planet and just mayhem of unimaginable proportions, they thought that was originally the deluge. That has now been re-scripted. They've realized that the deluge, there was two things that have changed. And of course, there's certain forces who want to make you think it's just one. But they realized that the deluge was a little bit longer ago, and my work also confirms that the deluge was previous to this. The event that we're talking about now was described in the ancient books as the War of the Gods, literally as a War of the Gods with the super weaponry that they had. The Egyptian papyrus have the most stunning accounts of this. The book of Revelation, go to verse 12, talks about the war in heaven. A book of Samuel, and a very important book that was left out of the Bible called the Book of Baruch, B-A-R-U-C-H. The Book of Baruch talks about the giants. There's a quote from the Book of Baruch which says, "There were those giants famous from the beginning that were so great of stature and so expert in war." Again, you know, the historian Manetho talks about it. There's a papyrus in Egypt from 2,000 years B.C. called the Upuar papyrus. All of this stuff is in the book, so you know, don't have to take notes. But the Book of Isaiah, there are just absolutely thrilling accounts in all the legends of the world of this horrendous fight that took place. And, of course, what interests me, and I know interests you, is the fact that great weaponry was used here. So in Book of Job, remember we talked about the symbolic literacy bit? In the book of Job 14, there's a very short passage which says, "And he shall flee from the iron weapon, and the bow shall strike him through." When we read chapters like that, we have to put it in context. Yeah, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, before we in our Western world had moved into some of the technologies we're discovering now, if you had read that, it wouldn't have made a bit of sense. But see, now, because we're in the 21st century, we can review a lot of this and say, wait a minute, iron weapon, the bow shall strike him through. There's other passages that talk about these super weaponry, and we can start to understand it in a new context. And in a very well-known and sacred Indian book called the Srimad Bhagavatam, this thing is about 50 volumes. 50 volumes, and many of these volumes feature this thing with the War of the Gods. And they talk about the... there's a passage there which talks about a demon race which invaded the planetary systems. Opposing them was the Hindu god Shiva, who possessed a powerful weapon that he fired at the enemy airships from his own. You know, Ovid, the great Greek, in his book Metamorphoses, he talks about the giants attacked the very throne of heaven, and Jupiter, you know, struck them down. The Norse Edda is filled with it. The Norse Edda is one of the greatest scriptures for this, by the way. It has the most interesting accounts of the weaponry, along with the Vedas. They talk about also the evil afterwind, you know, like the residue, sort of the aftershock, or what you might call the...
Fallout?
The fallout, yeah. The Norse Edda talks a lot about that. But the most famous accounts, let's say, were... before I go on to the Mahabharata, which has the most interesting accounts, there's Exodus 7. Let me draw your attention to Exodus 7, where it says, "And Moses and Aaron did as the Lord commanded, and he lifted up the rod and smote the waters that were in the river, and all the river waters that were in the river were turned to blood." This bit of you always hear about the rod is actually a weapon of some kind. So in the Bible, when you hear that, just remember, you're hearing about a form of weaponry, and if you read the rest of the passage, suddenly it'll start to be clear. But for those who are fascinated by the idea of just focus on this one area, for people who are not even into this whole thing, if they just get a grip on this one area of super weaponry, super technology, ancient technology, this will open up a vast area of research. And I'll read a few quotes from the ancient mythologies. In the Mahabharata, dates from thousands of years BC, and when it was first written down, those scribes said it was already thousands of years old by that time, which pushes it back to about 20,000 years, 14,000 years, and so on. This is a direct quote from the Mahabharata, the ancient text of India. It says, "The Subha," this is the spacecraft, "the Subha clung to the sky at a league's length. He threw at me rocks, missiles, spears, spikes, battle axes, three-bladed javelins," right, we know about those heat-seeking missiles and the ones, what's that, the Scud missiles that split open or whatever? Well, they're talking about the three-bladed javelins, flamethrowers, without pausing. "The sky seemed to hold 100 suns, 100 moons, and 100 myriad stars. Neither day nor night could be made out, or the points of the compass." The Ramayana, which is another one of the great Indian texts, mentions an iron thunderbolt capable of killing hundreds of thousands of humans. It was also said to be so powerful that it would have destroyed the earth. These weapons could only be used by royal decree. There's even passages where it mentions the fact that the weapon was used first as retaliation for the other side using it first. I mean, where have we heard that story before, right? Then there's a book called the Samargana Sudrahara. There is mention of manned space rockets as well as their means of propulsion. In the book known as the Samara Sudrahara, we find mention of the use of biological weapons, each of which produces its own specific results. There's a weapon called the Samhara, which debilitated its victims by attacking the motor center of the brain. And then the other weapon that they refer to is the Moha, M-O-H-A, which caused blockage of nerve impulses, resulting in complete paralysis. In a Chinese book called the Feng Shen Veni 1, we find descriptions of germ warfare, and again references made to specific weapons causing specific results. We have in the Mahabharata translations of this, because I know your next question is, my goodness, how come we didn't know about this before? Because when the British forces, again, just like they'd done in Ireland, when they moved into India and commissioned the translation of these books, they generally left these descriptions out. They would have said they thought they were fanciful. Well, if they're fanciful, then just leave them in and let everybody make up their mind. No, they were left out for other reasons. At Mohenjo-daro in India, just like in the Iraqi desert, there has been crystallized, fused glass found beneath the soil. If you go down there, you'll find what looks like fused glass, implying that nuclear explosions had taken place. They found that at Sodom and Gomorrah, the place where they say that Sodom and Gomorrah took place in the Asia Minor. They found tektites, radioactive tektites, to this day. In Scotland, there's a castle with one whole side of it is just fused glass. It's something that hit it, you know. The legends locally talk about the very things we're talking about here. Here's another quote from the Mahabharata, which is very famous. It's in the book. It says, "It was as if the elements had been unleashed. The sun spun round, scorched by the incandescent heat of the weapon. The world reeled in fever. Elephants were set on fire by the heat and ran to and fro in a frenzy. Water boiled, animals died. The enemy was mown down, and the raging of the blaze made the trees collapse. Horses and war chariots were burned up. Thousands of chariots were destroyed. Then deep silence descended on the sea. The corpses of the fallen were mutilated by the terrible heat so that they no longer looked like human beings. Never before have we seen such a ghastly weapon, and never before have we heard of such a weapon.
And this wasn't written in, like, 1950. This is...
6,000 years B.C., at least. We know that because if you cross-reference it with the Irish text, you're going back that far. Now, another quote from the same... And these are volumes long. I mean, the Mahabharata would probably fill, you know, from here to the ceiling, right? A single projectile, it says, charged with all the power of the universe. An incandescent column of smoke and fire as bright as 10,000 suns from a shaft fatal as the rod of death. There's that rod of death bit again, which the Bible uses. Endowed with the force of a thousand-eyed Indra's thunder, it was as destructive to all living creatures. Hostile warriors fell to the earth like trees burned down in a raging fire. A substance like fire has sprung into existence, blistering hills, rivers, and trees. All are being reduced to ashes. You cruel and evil ones, drunk with pride, through that iron bolt, ye shall become exterminators of your race. When we read that story about Lot and his wife in the Bible, where it says, don't turn back because you'll turn into a pillar of salt, that's a mistranslation. The original Aramaic, the original Hebrew translation is not salt, it's vapor. The word is much more like our English, you'll turn into a vaporous, you'll just disintegrate. From, and this, by the way, anyone who wants this translation of the Mahabharata, it is the Protan Chandra Roy. Okay, so it's Protan Chandra Roy's translation in 1889. Has these particular things. But, of course, if you just want to get my book, it's all in there. So it says, another quote says, Gurkha, flying in his swift and powerful Vimana, and the word Vimana translates into flying craft, by the way, hurled against the three cities of the Varishis and the Andhakas. These are the two groups that they're talking about. And very much like I've been saying, I use terms like Atlantean and Lemurian. And another one of the most confirming things is they always talk about just two main contingents. Why not six or seven or five or four or 50? It's always the two. Because they're talking about what we've been mentioning here. Well, they hurled a single projectile charged with all the power of the universe. It was an unknown weapon, an iron thunderbolt, a gigantic messenger of death, which reduced to ashes the entire race of the Vrishnis and the Andhakas. So they're talking about both sides had casualties. The corpses were so burned as to be unrecognizable. Now listen to this. The hair and nails fell out. Pottery broke without apparent cause, and birds turned white. After a few hours, all foodstuffs were infected. To escape from this fire, the soldiers threw themselves into streams to wash themselves and their equipment. The weapon was so feared that in great distress of mind, and that's a direct quote, the king had the bolt reduced to fine powder and thrown into the sea. Even with these precautions, people's hair and fingernails fell out overnight. Birds turned white and their legs became scarlet and blistered, and food went bad. You know, we have in Pakistan, 44 exhumed skeletons were found. Every one of them was found to be radioactive.
Whoa, when was this?
This is recorded in Jonathan Cray's Dead Man's Secret in the 19th century. And they dated these skeletons to 2,000 years B.C. We have, let me see, there's...
2,000 B.C., that's quite...
Later. You see how late it is? Yeah. But again, what do
if
we
we're
know?
If we're talking the timeline...
Timeline is a whole other question about who's doing the timing and what have you. Now, the most important part of this, I mean, it just goes on and on. There's, as I said, this is a whole subject in itself. I want to read you one more very, very important quote that I found concerning this vast thing with the weaponry. In the Celtic legend, in the earliest times of conquest of Ireland. Now, remember, you remember the whole thing with the luck of the Irish? Here we are in St. Patrick's Day today, and everybody's screaming about the luck of the Irish, you know? Where that actually comes from is interesting. It comes from what we're talking about. In this cataclysm, what both contingents didn't realize is that the ferocity of this war would affect the earth itself. They say that the moisture in the atmosphere pretty much incinerated. And that the magnetic polarity of the Earth was affected grossly. And it precipitated what we know as a polar shift. So the event that happened 14,000, 13,000 years ago was not the deluge, but it was a polar shift of our axis. There's lots of evidence we don't have time to go into here to point out that about that time the Earth's axis was straight. It was what they call tholeiform, in which you had what the Greeks call ver perpetuum, perpetual spring. This is known now. The Earth went off its axis. Now, a lot of people put before you again the whole idea of pole shift means the whole reversal of the Earth. It doesn't mean that at all. It can mean a variety of different things, even just a little nudging of the axis. But this thing where we are now, 23.5 degrees or whatever it is, this occurred at this time because of this humanoid ferocity of this battle. They claim that the whole earth was shaken. Millions of species were wiped out. Vast amount of destruction, like we're saying here. The moon was drawn even closer to our orbit. Mars was affected badly. There was tumult. Remember, we're talking about other reasons why the Nephilim couldn't leave. They had now precipitated something. They had no idea. It's like an H.G. Wells' idea. He says where the earth responded to man's violence, and then earth's violence. It's very true what he's saying there. None of the sides realized this was going to happen. The earth literally around them starts moving now. What we have to understand is that deluge is one thing. You know, even bad as it is, you know, rocks and water falling down from the heavens and all sorts of calamity like that, that's horrendous. And after a couple, it takes hundreds of years to even a semblance of normality to return to the earth. Pole shift, on the other hand, is a completely different thing. That's like, you know, the Eiffel Tower stuck head first in Hawaii. That's boulders the size of mountains, you know, flying through the air. I mean, it's unimaginable. They say the whole Miocene Ocean, which was one point a time in Russia, spilled out and became the Mediterranean, leaving only the Caspian and Black Sea. Nothing could even, you know, begin. It's written in our DNA. I mean, this is mentioned in our racial memory, but nobody can describe this. The scientists and anthropologists who've studied the flora and the fauna and the destruction, and these things called erratic boulders, which are found thousands of miles away from where the, you know, the crops of rock were. They've discovered all of this. This is monumental cataclysm. Well, this event, what did it do? It sank the great continents. Not just Atlantis and Lemuria. There were three other ones that the ancients talk about. There was actually four continents in all. Appalachia, there was one called Tyrrhenia, which is where the Mediterranean is now. Oceania, which was Lemuria, and Beringia and Fennoscandia. So we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different continents that sank beneath the ocean, and that's exactly what the Celtic legends say. In the earliest books of the Celts, when they say, hey, where you guys come from? They say, we come from four, like an archipelago of islands. So again, another disinformation about Atlantis being the only thing that sunk. There was many great continents that spanned the earth which were gone forever beneath the ocean. And that accounts for why today, when Jim Allen and many of these other well-meaning researchers go and they turn over a rock and go, I found it! It's Atlantis. No, that's another outpost or station or whatever. It doesn't necessarily mean it's Atlantis itself. Now, the want to get back to this thing where the Celtic legends, when they, the luck of the Irish, when they survived, the remnants who might have survived this tumult get into boats, just like in the Mayas, they even show you pictures of it. I mean, you can go to the Maya and see pictures of the guys rowing away from this almighty, you know, sunken island and stuff like that. It's actually images of this. In Ireland, there was a succession of 5 invasions to Ireland, and they called Ireland the Blessed or the Fortunate Isles because it had survived. It was one of the land masses that they were able to settle on, and that's where you get the original idea of the Irish being lucky, because the land there was considered our salvation. And it's very interesting, beautifully poetic, it's mostly poetic, in fact, about the fact of the relationship with people with Ireland. That's also why mountains are sacred. Because mountains were, at that time, the only place where people could have survived, you see. So the mountain entered our mythologies as being sacred, the sacred mountain, which was the salvation of man. But the 5th race that came to Ireland were the High Magicians. In Irish mythology, there is no bones made about it at all. That each of these races was unique. They were, had godlike powers. But the if you count the original indigenous people of Ireland, these very strange hybrid beings that were there, then it's the 5th race that came, and they were called the Gaelic people. And the Gaelics were the High Druids. So when we're talking about the Druids, we're talking about a specific group of people. They had a king whose sword, by the way, is the prototype of Excalibur. So for those who are into the Arthurian legend, this Gaelic tribe that came, every member of it is the prototype that of later that was rescripted in the story of King Arthur. Their Merlin was called Evergain. Evergain was the poet, the bard, the one with magical powers that Merlin was based on. The king's sword, which was called Retaliator, became, you know, Excalibur. Their physician turns up in mythologies. Their great king turns up as Hercules and other giants, stories in England. And they had a son king. The right-hand man to the king was called Lugh, L-U-G-H. Now listen to this account of the weapon that he had. And again, think about, if we heard this 50, 100 years ago, it would have made no sense at all. Old wives' tale. Now that we have the weaponry we have, let's think again. The caption goes, Lugh, he also had a magic spear, which he had no need to wield himself, for it was alive and thirsted for blood. When battle was near, it was drawn out, then it roared and struggled against its thongs. Fire flashed from it. It tore through and through the ranks of the enemy, never tiring of slaying. There it is. 5,000 years BC. Heat-seeking missile. Doesn't need to be even held. And in fact, I've read accounts where Lou has to, and it has to be like, there's about 9 bodyguard guys that have to like move this thing around. And he's warning them, for God's sake, be careful, put it back in its body. There's even descriptions that if you, you know, go near it, they had to put all sorts of things over it because it would freak them out. It would destroy their hair and their fingernails would fall out. Same thing we hear about King David in the Ark. Remember where he's, I think same thing we have Moses going onto the mountain, coming back all bleached white. Same thing we have all over the world about the dangerous weaponry. And there's a whole story in that alone. So from Celtic Ireland to the Mahabharata to the Popol Vuh, you've got accounts of this incredible stuff.
You can't. I mean, obviously, we're talking about a day and age where this just wouldn't have come out of thin air, so to speak. It was it had to have been introduced.
And remember, that's why I read you that particular caption. Can't we see clearly how even 100 years ago that would have been meant nothing to us? About the whole idea of it moving at its own free will. What would we have said about that? We would have said, oh, that's magic. It's a magical story, something moving at its own free will. That would have been put down to magic. What my work is very much based on and why I focus so much on the Celtic stuff is that because now is finally the time to dig all of this stuff out. They talk about the cauldron of life. Ask anyone who studied Celtic mythology for like 5 minutes who opened a coffee table book on it, and there you will see the cauldron of life. What does the legend say? That the dead or dying heroes will be put inside the cauldron and they'll come out alive. That's what the legends are saying. Well, it makes no sense until you think, wait a minute, could that be some primitive, you know, cryogenic chamber or ozone chamber? We see it in The Day the Earth Stood Still, that famous movie where the guy is dead. He really is dying. But they what does he say? They restore him temporarily to a semblance of life. You know, this once was science fiction. The Celts were talking about it thousands of years ago. And remember, I'm only touching on this. When you get into these tribes in general and talk about...
It's hard to cover just the scope of what we're talking about. But to get to the point where, you know, we're talking about how technology somehow came about, we really had to talk about it in terms of your research and what you put together. We had to bring everybody up to this
very
point
important.
To understand
right.
the context of this.
Right. Context is extremely important because, you see, a lot of people... And this is one of the reasons why we haven't really been sold on a lot of this, because anybody can just jump in at one particular area anecdotally and blow this thing up and go, here you go. And then, of course, we're right not to believe it. In my work, I don't know, maybe it's because of my British background, beginning, middle, and end is very important in this. You have to present the background because doing this anecdotally just will not work. And I actually refuse to do it. You know, it's not something that is just anecdotal like that. This is very, very serious alternative history.
My question at this point is, okay, so we've got these descriptions of, you know, horrific events that have been chronicled cross-culturally. You know, there's no argument there. People want proof, it's there.
It's in the pudding, as they say.
But yeah, proof is in the pudding. But these weapons, this horrible thing happened to the planet, but what happened to these weapons? Or why did all of a sudden, we're talking about these tremendous magical powers, and then for years or thousands of years,
we don't
nothing.
Have it.
And then all of a sudden, almost instantaneously, overnight, you know, it seems that in the 20th century, all of a sudden technology just boom explodes and accelerates at just a colossal rate.
Well, you're talking about something that has puzzled me from the outset when I started to read this. This was on my mind. What we're really talking about is where did it all go?
Yeah.
So if we're right here and this happened and these kinds of things happen, why do we not have it now? This is what makes my work completely different than every other writer, by the way. For those who are really paying attention to what we're saying, this particular thing you've just said is the difference between Michael Tesorian's work and everybody else. Nobody can account for that. It's very simple. We've already accounted for it, really. The pole shift. The pole shift was not foreseen. The sinking of the continents meant that with it went all of Atlantis, all the citadels, all the spacecrafts, a great deal of the technological hardware. I mean, you've seen Superman in the movie going up north. Right? There's a lot of ancient Celtic symbolism in this about going north to Hyperborea. What does he do? He goes into the underground chamber where all his crystal, you know, computers are. That was all destroyed. All this kind of technology, a great deal of it, was destroyed, leaving only a very little left. And I always liken it to the American gunfighter of your frontier days. You know, he takes his gun away from him, he feels what they call naked. I mean, you can have it all up here in the head, but if you don't have your weaponry and your technology, what are you going to do? These individuals were raped of their own technology by their own ferocity. And the Book of Enoch and these things even mention that. Now, here's a very interesting quote. Earlier on, we talked about, did the experts believe in this? There's a particular anecdote that involves Oppenheimer. He was the theoretical physicist, remember, and supervising scientist of the Manhattan Project. And he was also very, very skilled in Sanskrit literature. He even read Sanskrit in its original. Mm. And he was a very great aficionado of the ancient books. Well, while he was giving a lecture at Rochester University, and I actually met, I think I heard from, by email, the guy who actually asked him this question. So I'm actually in contact with the guy who asked this question. He's a person who's read my book and has been in contact with me. This person got up and asked Dr. Or Professor Oppenheimer a very interesting question. He says, was the bomb that you exploded at Alamogordo during the Manhattan Project the first one to be detonated? That's kind of a weird question in the first place. But his answer is even more bizarre. Oppenheimer goes, well, yes, in modern times, of course. Well, do they know something we don't know, you know? And the same thing goes with Professor Hermann Oberth, who's literally, after he was brought to America, the father of space travel theoretics, was very much talking about people from other worlds. Remember we talked about the destruction of the second sun? Another one of the interesting things that you need people to look into is etymology. Why a sun? The word sun comes from the word sol, S-O-L. Sol is the word root of solitary, solo, right, soliloquy, and so on. Sol, which is the name of our sun, means the alone one, the solitary one, implying that at one point it wasn't solitary. Luna, which is the name of our moon, means a luna, alone. That's where the word comes from. The word alone comes from luna. The ancients, after watching the destruction of the second sun, now began to habitually refer to sun and moon as the alone ones. They're missing their cousin. The word that we use for these cataclysms still exists. Disaster means, you know, when we talk about something terrible happening, we say that's a bloody disaster. Dis means to be without. Aster is a star. The destruction of a star. Catastrophe means the same thing. Astrophe meant astra, the star, and kata means to break down. So the breaking down of a star. The word typhoon, which also used to be from the Egyptian the Typhonian beast. Typhoon means the Typhonian serpent, the beast that was unleashed in the skies that caused tremendous trouble. Hurricane. Cain is from the old word meaning serpent, and hurry means to shake, the shaking of the serpent. Even the etymology of our world preserves this stuff. But you're right. There was an unforeseen variable, because after all, look at it, to embellish upon your point. If we're talking about something that happened at very least 11,000 years ago, and probably about 13,000 years ago, and we're talking about evil contingents on the earth that wanted to enslave us and so on, and then we have a rival faction who want to liberate us. Well, wait a minute. How come neither of those two scenarios, you see, has then manifested? If the Atlanteans are one, we would be in chains or doing, you know, slaving around. And if the Lemurians' paradigm had worked, then we'd all be living pretty much in peace and harmony on a beautiful planet. How come neither of those two things have happened? Because of the unforeseen variable of the pole shift. It changed things totally. And this is why neither side triumphed. All the technological hardware was destroyed. The Atlanteans realize that they basically have to start again. The story goes that the Atlanteans, remnants of them, decide to go to where the new equator is, to the only place that will sustain life all year round, which was Asia Minor. And it's from there, from Asia Minor, from the Euphrates and Tigris area, that the cultures of official history begin. They're based on the Atlantean pattern. That's why they were bloodthirsty. That's why they were agrarian. That's why they were city-state. That's why money started to be used. The calendar came into power. Conquest of your neighbors. Blood rituals. All the mayhem of all the modern empires leading up to today are based on a particular pattern that we have, that's been hidden, what it's really based on. Now, we come back to Zachariah Sitchin, the original point of why I have the major problems with him. It stands to reason. Yes, he's digging up, fine. He's digging up Sumerian Babylonian seals. He's translating them. His scholars are translating them. They're analyzing those. But wait a minute, we got a question now. If these civilizations in the Middle East, in Asia Minor, are patterned on the Atlantean pattern, who writes the history? So yes, Zachariah Sitchin is doing fantastic work reading Akkadian, reading Sumerian. But wait a minute, isn't history always written by the victors? So what the poor guy doesn't realize, because he's starstruck, well, in a way he should be, because what he's discovered is a remarkable, but he's made a fundamental error. Of course they're going to push the date of their coming back to 400,000 years ago. Of course they're going to say X, Y, and Z, you see, which is not necessarily true, because they're writing the history. And just because this now looks old and exotic to us, doesn't mean that you forget common sense. These were the tyrants of the world. These are people that you can't just take verbatim what they're saying. You certainly have to cross-reference it with other groups. And that's what my work has done. Now, the Lemurians decide to do the opposite. For safety reasons or whatever reason, they decide to split and diverge themselves. They don't converge. They disperse to all corners of the planet. And that is why we have this thing called dispersion. The same rites, the same rituals, the same symbols, the same etymology, the same dances, the same symbolism coming to all parts of the globe. It's a well-known fact. A lot of people can't answer that. It's because it's one group taking it there. One group of the Lemurian High Ones and their Adamic wards going to all parts, marrying in with anyone that might have found as remnants there, which is the old story. Now you got to piece it together. And that's why you have these two sort of things happening. And most importantly, you have the rise of the great, God, the whole idea of the central God, and then the devil, who's going to get your ass. All of this stuff comes out, the patriarchal society, the meat diet society, all of these things that are punitive and tyrannical coming out of the Middle East. A very important aspect there I cover in the book. And that, of course, brings us up to basically modern times because, not even in my work, I can't track every single event that these individuals have done. But the most important thing to realize is that these guys just don't take no for an answer. The Atlanteans decided to artificially push mankind history forward to the point where they could rebuild the hardware that they had lost.
So everything is being accelerated artificially.
Yeah. And you don't need Gene Roddenberry or Rod Serling. Many more people than them have always lamented. Why is it that our scientific advancement is so far in excess of our emotional and psychological development? This has haunted many thinkers down through time. Well, of course it is. If you're artificially, there's something moving it forward, that's the answer. Now, it seems preposterous, but it's like Sherlock Holmes said, once you exclude the impossible, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, must be the truth. Well, we're in the century now for this improbable stuff to come in front of us. It makes a hell of a lot more sense than what we've been handed from the pulpit, what we've been handed from the enclaves of science, who are not that concerned too much with the moral question. And these are things that are besetting us. We need a new science that involves a lot of these researches and discoveries, and many of them are heading the way, like Richard Milton, wrote that book, Shattering the Myths of Darwin, which I recommend. Alan and Dallaire, Flint and Otto Binder. There's many other scientific people that I mentioned whose work I draw upon because, in fact, we cannot understand our modern age. And we certainly cannot understand history if we do not understand there's been an unseen hand working to artificially push people forward. This Empire of Atlantis, the remnant of it, has spread its tentacles to all parts of the modern world. They wanted the mines. They wanted to get the ores because this is a humongous job. Now you've got to subjugate the entire planet. You've got to get the ores, the minerals, it's unimaginable. But it still can be done. See, theoretically for them, on paper, it could be done. They've probably done it on their own planet, and you don't really have any choice. What are you going to do, sit around, whittling on a piece of wood, or are you going to get with it? Well, these beings got with it. And that's why there's a colonialistic motive coming out of the first of these centuries, and the spread of war and mayhem, and anyone or anything standing in their way, they'd find a way to wipe it out. And the movement of races is very much involved in this as well, because, of course, now that the Earth was in tremendous tumult, you didn't have much choice where you went. You basically went where the geography allowed you to go. So there was a lot of other factors that we need to take into consideration. Now, one point I want to bring up is that the genetic experiments didn't stop either. And this will help clean up a lot of information of people who've been researching David Icke and others who talk about the reptilians. Because, again, one of the most outstanding pieces of disinformation is that a lot of people in this field think that the beings that I'm talking about, the Nephilim, were reptilian or reptilian-like. This is not true. Although they didn't have a lot of their hardware, they had some, and they certainly had a lot of knowledge. So after they set up their bases, their new headquarters in Assyria, Babylon, Sumeria, and what have you, they tried some primitive genetic experiments. And this time they gave up all thought of doing it on humanoids because that had never worked for them. They thought, look, every time we've tried that, it's gone awry. So they said, well, there's other life forms on the planet. So they started what we would call this other experimentation on the fauna. And they found that the DNA of the reptile, worked when it crossed with their alien DNA. And that is the advent of the beings that all mythology also talks about is the reptilian or the dragon beings. It's also the reason why we have the unicorn, the centaur, the minotaur, the dragon, all sorts of hybrid beings that seems to be that, even though there's been a lot of cover-ups, the sirens of Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. Up until the Middle Ages, Middle Ages is full of this stuff. In fact, we all know the story of the hero who has to go and prove he's a man or a hero. He has to knock on the door of some hybrid like that and fight him. And then you put the symbol on your shield. So this was something that was a done deal in the medieval days. And I believe that these beings still exist, a lot of them. But they were sort of sequestered out after, you know, the modern age came in. You couldn't have these people, these beings walking down Main Street. And just like any offspring, some will look more reptilian. I mean, scales and all. And some will look perfectly humanoid. And so there's people who have visitations today. There's many accounts of people having seen these beings. Of course, David Icke is the big authority on that right now. And I'd just like to clear up a little bit of his disinformation. They don't come from another planet. They were made here on Earth by beings that once were from other planets. The DNA was crossed with animal life forms.
Wait, could they have really lived that long? I mean,
okay, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Now, what we're talking about is the lifespan of the originals. No, okay. The answer is no. Even if you think that they may have lived 700 years, there's an accounts for that, or 1,000 years, obviously they don't live 11,000 years, right? So yeah, they've died, or they've perished, let's say, the originals, but then they have their descendants. And we all, in a way, are their descendants. Anyone who today who carries the Adamic strain or the Homo Atlantean strain has the alien DNA. We're lumbered with the schism within ourselves genetically. It brings the immorality we have softly within ourselves every day. We wake up, it's ingrained in us. Will I climb on another person to get ahead? You know, is it good to steal? You know, shall I lie? This soft evil that's in us, and then there's the mega evil, the mega death on the social front. So all of that, from the psychological component of the human being all the way up to the physical manifestation of serial killers and mass murders and what have you on the earth, actually comes from this problem of the DNA. The ancients used to liken it to the two dragons fighting each other, or the two twins in conflict with each other, Mordred and King Arthur, you know, Dylan and Lou. Cain and Abel, Jesus and Lucifer, you know?
Is this also a yin-yang, or...?
Yeah. In fact, the yin-yang symbol used to be called the eyes of the serpent, representing the black and white serpents. You have, don't you, you have the conflict of... let's think of some of the primordial conflicts. You have, there's so many of them, Horus and Set, you know? The whole idea of the two twins fighting for regency. In fact, there's a poem from the Old Testament, when it's meant to be talking about Jacob and Esau, but it works so well. It says, "In your limbs lie nations twain, rival races from their birth. One the mastery shall gain, the younger or the elder reign." So the two dragons in Arthurian legends, they talk about the white dragon and the red dragon in conflict with each other, in perpetual rivalry. And it's the two parts of our own consciousness. It's
which two parts?
The alien proclivity and the humanistic proclivity. Now, of course, conditioning matters too. I think that the idea on Lemuria was that the Lemurians were going to help to, you know, condition out these alien genes. They may have even done that with interference on the genetic level, or they may have just done it by conditioning over time to get that out. And some of us are like that. Some people in the world, the Mozarts, Beethovens, Salvador Dalis, whatever, they have that more humanistic side. They're so connected to the universal matrix, so tuned in. And then you get the other side, which is, you know, it's the whole Star Trek, you know, double-sided guy, right? You know, we are these schizoid beings, and because we're schizoid beings, we create a schizogenic society. And we're all laboring under this problem right now. And many people have questioned, you know, what we can really do about it. But there's a historical component to this as well, and that is that we have our history being artificially moved forward. Now, we have a very interesting book called the Emerald Tablets of Hermes, which is another one of the ancient scripts that was, I think, translated by the Medicis. Could be wrong there, but certainly it came into the West by way of the Romans. And one of the captions in that book says that, "Speak I of ancient Atlantis, speak of the days of the kingdom of shadows, speak of the coming of the children of shadows. Out of the great deep they were called by the wisdom of the earth man. In the form of man they moved amongst us, but only to sight were they as men, serpent-headed when the glamour was lifted. Crept they into councils, taking form that were like unto men, slaying by their arts the chiefs of the kingdoms, taking their form and ruling over man, to destroy man and rule in his place." So the ancient books are talking about deep magic, they're talking about weaponry, they're talking about psychic control, they're talking about mind control, they're talking about evil archies behind government.
So if they had the technology back then, if they had all these abilities back then, they may have lost, you know, certain elements,
yeah,
in their cache. But why take however many thousands of years to get us to the point where we are today.
Because it's a slow process. Some of these works talk about that that's not a pleasant thing for them. However, some of the works, William Bramley, in his book Gods of Eden, and there are several other ancient books like the Annals of the Four Masters, which is an old, again, one of these old volumes from Ireland, and a few other books like that, actually refer to the fact that during the Renaissance period, they'd already built back their spacecrafts. As weird as this sounds, so when we look at those Leonardo da Vinci drawings of, you know, the old helicopters and submersibles, that's not just him doodling, thinking, oh, tomorrow we'll have all of this. This is him recording what they once had, because he was an initiate into these secret societies. He was very much a member of some of these brotherhoods, and he was one of the people that is an official figure. He's one of the people that's above, you know, radar level, where we know him as a historical figure, but there are many who were put in charge of this building of this technology. So they were not just doodling and prophesizing for the future. They were people, agents of these secret societies, working on this particular paradigm, as the people behind MIT today and some of these other characters behind some of the scientific institutions are.
Wait a minute.
They're also involved in this.
That sounds so, and obviously this entire show sounds so fringe, because, and maybe it's alternative, if
right.
We could use that word, nature. But how, this is where I kind of get lost. I can follow the idea of technology and the concept of, as in the cradle of civilization, suddenly you mm-hmm. have a social structure and money and, you know, the concept of a patriarchal society, it had to have come from somewhere. That's the logic side speaking.
Right.
But when you start diving into and start talking about secret societies.
Yeah.
Whether they're called what's a common term, like Freemasons or
right. Illuminati. Whatever you want to call them, yeah.
That's where I'm not quite making that connection, because it just seems to me that maybe I subscribe to the thought on, well, if it happened or if it's happening, wouldn't we know about it?
Well, we do know about it. See, the thing is, we do know about it, but that when you study secret societies, it's a very separate, in a way, it's a separate type of research that very few people can make the connection. What you're talking about is a very difficult thing to do, is to try and, first of all, work out what is the alternative history of the world and then find out how these secret societies operate. Now, I'm trying to find this particular... here it is. In the Book of Enoch, this will help lead into what we're talking about. The artificial movement forward, you have to have custodians for that, and it has to be financed. And also, you have to have a pyramidical hierarchical structure when you're orchestrating all of this. One, because that works very well. And two, you have enemies out there. The Atlanteans have their rivals, so they want to conceal. As they're moving this down, they're not just doing it in the open. You have to conceal from your slaves your agenda. So this is where the idea started to happen, where you create cellular, hierarchical, self-enclosed structures, which is basically what the secret society, you know, system is. It's a system of decompartmentalization. So that, and the pyramid is the perfect symbol of that, like a hologram or a fractal. Each person working in their cell, just like the CIA operate, just like the triads operate, all of these criminal organizations work in this, the gangs of even New York work on a cellular structure, right? Well, anyway... In the Book of Enoch, it says, and Azazel, this is one of the dark angels, Azazel taught men to make swords and knives and shields and breastplates, and made known to them the metals of the earth and the art of working with them. And they were led astray, and men became corrupt in all their ways. The Welsh talk about it. The Smithsonian also has understood the Smithsonian Institute and the Bureau of Standards there in Washington have brought to light various objects that prove that 7,000 years ago, people were producing steel in furnaces at a temperature of 9,000 degrees centigrade. That's almost like the heat of the sun. Mm. It's just recently been proven. Dr. R.V. Dolphin, after studying the Libyan desert glass, he found little, you know, beautifully ornate glass and beads and necklaces, but Dolphin suggested that for the ancient Phoenicians to have worked with temperatures equivalent to 6,000 degrees Celsius, so nothing else could make these particular vessels, that they must have known the secret of atomic power. This is one of the top experts in that field. And 6,000 degrees is only 2,000 degrees short of the temperature of the sun. So again, official think tanks, organizations, bastions are discovering this. The word Europe Where do we even get that word? Europe, in Greek mythology, came from the goddess Europa, who was the daughter of the phoenix, which rose from what? The flames of destruction. The very name Europe was given because it's a miracle, right? Just like Ireland was called the Blessed Isles, the Fortunate Isles. Europe is the one who survived the flames, the cataclysm. Now, the people, the secret society thing ties in because these individuals created these orders in order to be fraternal in nature, to have degree ceremonies so that only initiated people would know what is the top. What is the top? Pick up any Masonic book and look at the 33rd degree, the 32nd, 33rd degree. I go into all of this in the second half of the Atlantis book. It says Prince of the Royal Secret, the Keepers of the Royal Secret, the Prince of the Brazen Serpent. These are the high degrees of Freemasonry. What secret? The secret of genetics, perhaps? Is that the royal secret? Well, the symbolism in Freemasonry shows you exactly that. And in the DVD I have coming out that's a companion of the book, I go into that very deeply. The whole occult history of America is detailed with meticulous detail in that DVD. It's 15 hours long, like we were talking earlier. It's a multi-DVD set. And it goes into the whole concept of the secret societies, and I will talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But one thing before I want to leave the old Celtic stuff, I think this is something monumental of importance. We must understand also that there wasn't just this vast technological expertise, you know. There was also this sort of clairvoyant ability. And after one of the great wars in Ireland, the west coast of Ireland, when these demonic forces were fighting with the Sons of Light won a particular series of wars about 5,000 years ago. And of course, being a matriarchy, the priestesses at the end, one of the priestesses meant to have gone to the Mourne Mountains to celebrate. The armies went to celebrate the defeat of their enemies. And she gave this prophecy. This prophecy is dated by Charles Squire and other Celtic scholars of 5,000 years ago. That's at least 3,000 and probably more thousand years BC. And here's the prophecy verbatim translated. It says, "Then she," this is the queen, "added a prophecy in which she foretold the approaching end of the divine age and the coming of a new one in which the summers would be flowerless, the cows milkless, and the women shameless, and men strengthless, in which there would be trees without fruit and seas without fish, when old men would give false judgments and legislators would make unjust laws, when warriors would betray one another and men would be thieves and there would be no more virtue in the world."
And when was this?
5,000 years BC. Now, you don't even really need to edit that or use too much intelligence to realize what era she was talking about, because that is what you see outside your window every day today. And think that's bad? In the Norse Edda, this is the Scandinavian mythologies, what? Several hundred miles, 1,000 miles, you know, west in the Teutonic. You have in the Norse Edda almost the same thing. A female high priestess says this, Then she saw wade in heavy streams, men, foul murderers and perjurers, who them other wives seduced to sin, brothers to slay brothers, sisters' children shed each other's blood, hard as the world, sensual sin grows huge. These are the sword ages, the axe ages, shields are cleft in twain, storm ages, murder ages, till the world falls dead. So something was going on then, and they had prophecy to say, because of this, you know, the genetic, what I believe to be the genetic interference, the fact that these entities are still loose in the world, the Puranas, again, we're dabbling in this, we're just touching on some of this stuff. The word Adam, for instance, has been found out to mean cut off or divided. The word Atlantis literally means from Atlan, which means the broken pillar, the one whose foundations were shattered, you know. So the etymology is very, very key in looking at this. Now, the rise of the secret societies, specifically one event we can talk about, because again, to track in 11,000 years every single machination of these forces is some task, but something very specific happened in England in the 15th century that I think would answer your point that you made about one of the connections to the secret societies. And this is really going to test people's credulity or whatever you want to call it.
As if anything to this point
has not.
Yeah.
Well, that's
right.
Why we're thinking, why not just have the whole pie now, right? Well, what had happened was that, remember I was saying that the pursuers originally of the Nephilim who'd come from wherever, they had made ready to leave quickly. Before they left, they really even though they didn't have time to scan the planet, they thought that there may be a chance that on Earth here, the Nephilim were still alive and hiding out. So they erected around the Earth a sheath, what might be described as a sort of an etheric membrane. And this energy field of etheric energy, it's technology. It's a high form of technology, but it has probably some other magical etheric qualities to it, is still there. And it acts like a semi-permeable membrane. And what it does is it places the Earth in quarantine. This is exactly how the ancient texts are talking about it. They refer to it as the bottomless pit. And the Native American Indians talk about it as a great web in the sky. The Bible refers to it as the sea of glass. I like to refer to it as the Stargate. It's literally a gate. And the moon is its active component. It's like the lodestone around this thing. What it means is that anyone with the alien DNA cannot leave this planet, even if the technology was to be rebuilt. I think that the Nephilim discovered this, or the descendants of the Nephilim discovered this around the 15th century when they had spacecrafts enough to fly out into our solar system. These were, by the way, observed, and that's why they wrote it down. That's why I know that they had spacecrafts then, because it was recorded by people on Earth. Even in London, they say the king saw it. So these spacecrafts went up there and realized they couldn't get through. When they realized this, and that their own people from their other planet had done this, and that they didn't have the key to get out, they were in a real predicament now, because they just spent about 11,000 years trying to build back their technology. They knew, hey, we're making great progress here. But what does this mean? Even if we build all of this technology back, we're chained to the pit, we can't get out. All of the books, including the most ancient ones, talk about this incarceration, quarantine effect. There's so many books that ancient chronicles go into this, but it means that beings could probably still come into our solar system, but it's not possible for those with the alien DNA to leave. And I refer to this gate as the Stargate. And one of the Gnostic Gospels called the Pista Sophia, which is a very interesting book to read. Again, it was something that should have been included in the Bible, but was not. They refer to this as a great dragon whose tail is in its mouth. They say, in the outer darkness there is a huge dragon whose tail is in its mouth. And it also talks about it in Revelation 8, where they refer to the bottomless pit, and they say, the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star fall from heaven onto the earth, and to him was given the key of the bottomless pit. And then in the Epistle of Peter, another biblical work, it says, God spared not the angels that sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved unto the judgment. So this Stargate is also known in astrology. Those who study astrology, especially Chinese astrology, know that the Chinese refer to this as the head and tail of the dragon. They call it the dragon's nodes in astrology. And the whole idea in mythology of the dragon encircling something precious. You'll even see jewelry, an artwork of a dragon encircling a globe or a pearl or something of great price. Well, this comes from the idea of an encircling dragon energy encircling the earth itself. You'll see that motif a lot in artwork all over the world. In fact, the symbol of the dragon eating its own tail, which is known as the Ouroboros, is found throughout the planet, throughout all from the Mexico, Egypt, India. The Celtic tradition has the encircling dragon. And of course, when we hear about the great hero, where does this whole idea come from, where the hero has to go out and kill the dragon or slay the dragon? Has anybody ever even bothered to ask what on earth that motif would mean, or where it originally came from and what it's meant to signify? No, we don't. We just accept these things and don't really ask a lot of questions about it. But the fact is, again, that these are cryptic mythological motifs about the breaking through the Stargate and the slaying of the dragon, or the mastery of the dragon.
So they've got to be mad. They can't get out.
That's right. Now, what happened in the 15th century was that after they discovered this, the Tudor dynasty, now the word Tudor comes from tutor. It really meant the teacher dynasty. These were the direct descendants of the bloodline of the Atlanteans. Okay, so there's been many, the Habsburgs, the Merovingians, if anybody who knows that name, the Merovingian dynasties, who were the royal families of France. And then we have the Tudor dynasty of England, our direct bloodline descendants from the Atlanteans of old. They were put in charge of this problem. And the man that they chose to put onto the problem to be the sort of the champion of this discovery of how to break the Stargate problem was known as Sir John Dee. Now, people in the magical tradition who studied the history of magic and the history of astrology will know that name. John Dee was one of the most powerful black magicians in the world, and he worked with an Irish clairvoyant called Edward Kelly. The Queen of England used to get in their boat real late at night and float down the River Thames to John Dee's home, which is called Mortlake. And he had the greatest collection of books, thousands of times more than was in any of the libraries for hundreds of years. He was a very famous man. And his, one of his jobs, his like his daytime job, if you want to call it, was he was the ambassador to the court of King James or the court of the Queen. And when he would go and visit foreign dignitaries or be as an ambassador, he'd always write back in the old left-hand writing and the cryptic writing bit, you know, to his queen. But at the bottom of all the documents that John Dee would send back, he would write his code word 007. Okay?
So, so like a James Bond, so
James
to speak.
Bond is actually the MI5, MI6. Comes from a specific time and event. The Spencer family, which Lady Diana Spencer's forefathers, right? Edmund Spencer, John Dee, who was the original 007. John Dee formed what we know as British intelligence. The first secret society of the world that was a British intelligence was formed by John Dee. He was the leader of it. So when Ian Fleming, who was an initiate into all of this, decides to do something on his retirement, what does he do? Well, he sits down and writes about his own order, his own group, puts it as, again in front of us as fiction, and a myth is born. But very, very few people know. And you can go, you can actually see these works. I've got the pictures that show you in the DVD I'm producing on this. There's the 007. And if you look at the old MI5 logo, it's exactly the same logo as you have on your American dollar bill, of the Illuminati pyramid with the eye at the top. And the crown of the queen, she who must be obeyed, the virgin queen, Queen Elizabeth I. Now, so there's a lot. I have a whole chapter on John Dee in the book and his associates throughout the world. And John Dee discovered that, look, really, if there was meant to be a technological way of breaking through the Stargate, it probably wouldn't happen. He, being a powerful black magician and an occultist, decided on something different. He opened up what is called a portal, a pan-dimensional portal. I know this sounds far-fetched, but this is, you know, I'm not making this up. I'm just a scholar reading this information and piecing it together purely objectively. There are magical principles. He used a system of magic known as Enochian magic, which involves, you know, as you see all those quaint images of the magician standing in his circle and all of that. Again, that's put before us as this quaint, laughable thing, you know, in the encyclopedias of the world and movies are made. As a matter of fact, why have we never questioned why the symbols in magic are planetary symbols? See, again, you know, there's so many things put in front of us. The symbols of the planets, the symbol of the angels are often planetary symbols. In John Dee's system of magic, he was able to open portals, literally, to other dimensions, to what we would call oversouls, that the magicians or the occultists of the world call the Angeli, Motivori, the Cosmocrates. These are oversouls. They don't live on this dimension. They're intelligence for the other dimensions. That doesn't mean they're good. They're just, they're of a different dimension. He contacted these individuals, or these beings, let's say, these fourth dimensional entities, to see if they would have an answer to their earthly problem, and he was told that they did. There was solutions to this. They could open the gate in time. And again, this is another one. We've covered lots of events, but I've always tried to point out the one or two most important events, like, you know, the first thing that affected Earth history was this genetic hybridization. The next one down the line, I would say, would definitely be the pole shift and the loss of the technology, right? This has been major U-turns in our Earth history. And this one, in the 15th century, needs to go up as one of those all-important, what you might call junctions for Earth history. Dee was told that there were, I mean, he was given volumes of information. They even say that his consciousness was almost like, you know, frazzled, completely wiped out, insane, psychotic because of the stuff that was coming down. And he had to, you know, he had other, you know, people all over the planet, famous magicians in Europe, all working on deciphering this information that came down. But it all centered around two basic premises. One was that these beings that I call the macrobes, I'll explain why in a minute. The macrobes told John Dee that they had to learn how to release energy. They had to learn how to create matter from energy. Right? That was the first premise they were told. The first key to the Stargate concerned creating matter from energy. But that they were so dumb, they were told, that we'd have to show you that in two stages. So even, you know, point one has two stages to it. We'll have to show you how to first release energy from matter. Okay? The second key involved the properties of a certain element. And that element was silicon, is what they were told. Now, a lot of this made sense to them because, of course, remember, they were themselves from other planets and had, at one point, great sophisticated computer technology. But they were being retold this again.
The Windows Media stream for the live broadcast of The Chris Perillo Show is provided by Limelight Networks. Listen to the live Chris Perillo Show in Windows Media Player. Download the latest version of the player for Mac and Windows users at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.